Hello, everyone. Welcome to another exciting and informative and educational episode of Side Stories. I am here. Aaron is my name. Hello. With my wonderful co-host, Jacob.
Hello. Welcome.
Yes, we are continuing our series on the Seminole Wars today.
Indeed, we are.
So let's just get the show on the road here. Let's not dodder around.
Of course.
Real quick, do you have a recap for us, or should we just say watch the last episode?
Yeah, no, for certain, watch the last episode. I mean, that goes without saying. But
well, yes, watch all of our episodes.
Exactly. But for this recap, we'll keep it rather short. Just kind of a where we left off, rather than a recap, because watch the episode. But we left off with General Jackson marching into Florida. He's been handed a blank check to deal with the Seminoles. This is the first Seminole War. He deals with them, having considered them honorary Brits. We talked about how he treated Brits in the last episode. And then he temporarily occupies Pensacola to the anger of the Spanish, and then he finally leaves. And using that situation to his advantage, and country's advantage, actually, John Quincy Adams negotiates a Spanish cession of Florida to the U.S., legally confirming what Jackson has already kind of done.
So he wanted Florida, and he got Florida.
Exactly. He said, you know what? These people I'm sent to deal with, why don't I just take their home? And you know what he did?
He took their homes.
Conclusion, geez. Total Jackson victory.
Yeah, that man had a stunning ability to get exactly what he wanted.
Yeah, exactly.
Sheer force of nature, that guy.
Sheer force of will.
Again, I have a very quick aside here. I just wanted to
mention
that. Often people talk about political power, right? And having the means to do things.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't talk about the motivation, political willpower. Mm-hmm. To get things done, like the actual motivation and drive to do things is very, very important. Because there have been many great nations that have not had the willpower to go and do what they really wanted to do. And again, you can argue if what Andrew Jackson did was good or not. I'm not saying that in this context he was 100% justified. But what I am saying is that he had the willpower to do it, and so he achieved it because he also had the means of doing so.
Mm-hmm.
These children are the very key things that you need to actually become a success in politics. So learn that lesson well, as I'm sure we will find out throughout the rest of this episode, because as I have learned, there's a lot of political means and motive here that's going on, these very interesting kind of quagmire of the Seminole Wars.
Mm-hmm. Exact. That is very true. We'll actually get to the personalities part of this later, because it's very, very important. We're going to be focusing mostly on the U.S. Army today, because they are, in a way, the problem people. believe it or not, it's not them that are kind of the impetus of this war. It is mostly Congress to a lesser extent, mostly the Department of War, actually, who is in charge of, you know,
war.
Yes, actually, more accurately, relocation, because this isn't a war until their relocation policies start the war. And it's less obvious in the first Seminole War that, you know, relocation is a big deal, but relocation is going on throughout most of the Second Seminole War elsewhere as well. There's a Creek War in the 1830s that I'll touch on later that is concurrently going on with the Second Seminole War, but there's a lot before the Second Seminole War, which is the big one, as I mentioned last episode. So we'll just dive right into that, because, like I mentioned, personalities are important. We'll get to them, but first we have to get to the war. And I'll start pretty much right after Florida is acquired. We'll jump to 1823. A actual, like, legal reservation is established in Interior Florida, because, as we established last episode, Florida's mostly on the coasts at this point, where the actual settlements had been. So Congress is perfectly fine to rope off the interior as, well, just they're there. We don't want to deal with them. Jackson was down bad and took care of some of the problems, but they're in there. It doesn't matter. And it's the Army's job to deal with these reservations. And you'll see it later after the Civil War out west more notably, but this is kind of where they're starting to test out this system. I think everyone on both sides can later agree it's a horrible system.
Yeah, the reservations didn't really work out the way they were intended, nor did they work out the way they were unintended. Really didn't work, is what I'm saying.
It's like, there's certainly many, many points in this, and later we might touch on that. It depends on if we have some sort of epilogue about this. But the, like, intended consequences of, like, denial of land isn't it's not really the goal at this point in time. It is just acquisition of land for settlement, and, you know, these Seminoles are in the way. That typical kind of issue. But for the Seminoles, it's genuinely a fight to survive, and in a lot of ways, they're very, very justified for what they did. And that's the interesting part, because the army's there doing, you know, following orders, and the Seminoles are there trying to follow their way of life. And once again, from the start, you can see how this is not going to work out. But as we established last episode, again, Florida's a relatively rich area. There haven't been that many people settled here, so interior Florida was fine for a while. And they also had these relocation policies, which, if you didn't like Florida, well, at the time, the United States was now, you know, owning the land around you, essentially. They're willing to take you somewhere else. And there were plenty who did willingly go along with it because, well, they didn't have the best of land. It just, you know, luck of the draw, really.
What places did they end up in, those ones who willingly relocated?
At the time, called Indian Territory.
And
which
that's
was
Oklahoma?
Not yet, actually. Not yet. Okay. It was, like, West Arkansas.
Oh, I see.
West, I believe, Mississippi. I think Alabama was much more firmly in control. It's kind of a weird, that whole area, because there's that little bit that, you know, sticks down that really makes it, but
Louisiana?
Yes. Not Louisiana. No. That was pretty firmly established. It was kind of around Louisiana, actually, in between, like, from Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi.
I was trying
those,
to understand what sticking
kinda
down meant there. I'm like, do you mean Louisiana or, like, geography, or did you mean just, like...
I'm talking, like, the Gulf Coast stretch,
I see
you know?
What you're saying now.
Yep. Yeah. But, so, Indian Territory didn't touch the sea, as far as I'm remembering. I might
be
wrong.
That doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, it's, again, it's not great, but, yeah, it ended up being Arkansas, Eastern Oklahoma, and again, it gets moved over into actual Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. But yep, that's a whole thing that's for another day.
You may have heard a few stories about this, which we're not going into today.
Yes, exactly. But so there were relocations going on. By 1827, the army had reported that the Seminoles had been removed or were on the negotiated reservation and were peaceful. And this lasts for a while. And this whole time, however, there's calls for them to be removed entirely by settlers. Typical border tensions, not much to expound upon here. Pretty obvious. This is the same stuff that's been happening since colonization began. So, in 1828, however, Mr. Andrew Jackson becomes president. Another total Jackson victory.
After he was, I believe, denied it in 1824, right?
Correct.
Well, depends on what side the political you fall on still to this day, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe, but let's just say there was a whole debacle that went down. Then he came back with a vengeance.
Yeah, exactly.
The
and he would
of
not
which
be denied.
Rarely been seen in U.S. politics, but I guess we'll see how the next election cycle goes.
Oh, boy.
There's always the terror looming for the future, kids.
That is true. That is true. But so after Jackson's become president, things honestly don't, it's not that they don't change because relocation is still going on. Jackson pushes for it more than it had been before, but it was happening before. And that is worth noting. Jackson, you know, gets all this flack for being, you know, pro relocation, you know, completely unsympathetic, but he also fought these people. He also considered them honorary Brits, as I kind of mentioned, but possibly more importantly, it was going on before him, and he just pushed the policies to their limit, but this was not new. Then, in 1832, in kind of an early attempt to forcibly remove the Seminoles, who were still on the reservation, this was agreed to in a treaty, and they brought some chiefs to go inspect the new land that they would be going to out in Indian Territory. And out in Indian Territory, they signed the documents, being escorted by the army this whole time.
So possibly strong-armed into signing the
documents. Possibly. They did sign the documents that they're satisfied with the new land that they would be migrating to them and their tribes. Mm-hmm. There may have been some duress involved. It's unclear, though probably very likely. Because when they returned to their own lands in Florida, they denied that they had signed or that they claimed that they'd been pressured to be signed. There's a lot of chiefs involved here. But so the actual treaty, again, 1832, gave them 3 years to prepare to leave. And though the U.S. didn't even ratify this treaty that was written up, they ratified it in 1834. they counted the 3 years as having already started from 1832.
Because,
which
of course.
Was, yeah, kind of rude, let's say that. So they expected the Seminoles gone by 1835. So they reopened forts. They started garrisoning the army to help them move. Help them move. Yeah, very, very low blows here. And at a newly reopened fort, the newly appointed agent to the Seminoles, Wiley Thompson. Yeah, it's not often you see the name.
Fascinating name.
Mm-hmm. He called all the chiefs together to kind of confirm that the plans were still in motion. The chiefs told him, in no uncertain terms, that they had no real intention of leaving, mostly due to, you know, the false treaty that they were forced to sign saying that they would move. And, you know, Thompson waved his piece of paper and said, you guys signed this. And they said, no, he didn't. And there was, you know, kind of that standoff.
This would happen a lot more in a few decades.
Yes. Yes, exactly. This is kind of the first real parts of it, too. That's why it's kind of interesting.
This really was the testing grounds for, like, the second half of the 1800s Indian Wars, wasn't it?
Exactly. That's kind of what I'm aiming to prove here, because there is very little here that doesn't come up later. And that's what's really, really interesting.
Interesting thesis you have here. Continue.
Yes. It's not my original, I must admit. There are plenty of people who are just like, yep, this is important for this exact reason. There's clearly a lot of work done on this as well, because a lot of the people involved here wrote, you know, journals, diaries that they published. The one that's actually most famous is Sherman's, which is much later, by the way. This is
Sherman, we mean William Sherman,
yes.
Famous for the Civil War.
Yes, not the tank.
No, that would have been funny if they had those, though.
Exactly, yeah. But, yeah, so essentially, this is a very studied part of history, actually, which is good, but just not well known. It's kind of an academic area, which is
there's a very interesting disconnect from heavily studied to heavily
understood
taught.
Yeah, exactly.
All of the Middle Ages,
yep.
All of it.
Yeah, that's pretty accurate. But essentially, yeah, things get talked about a lot here, which is why my version of this is very, very pared down. There is so much going on. You'll see a lot of it later. Once again, I mentioned personalities. We'll get to the like 5 or 6 personalities. It's literally a general a year during this, and it goes on from 1835 to 1842. So there's a different person for 7 years.
Oh, gosh.
Seven different strategies, 7 different people in charge. It's kind of awful, but again, I've pared it down here. We'll talk about it, but
fascinating but obscure history. It needs to be somewhat pared down to make consumable for the general public. Wow, this is an episode of Side Story,
yeah,
isn't it?
Exactly. It's kind of our brand.
This is our
point.
Thing.
Yeah. But so going back to Mr. Wiley Thompson.
What a great name.
Yeah, it is. It is. I really did think Wile E. Coyote the first time I read it. So I just had to... You don't see Wiley that often.
It's not a common name, to be fair.
Mm-hmm. But essentially, yes, there is the standoff with the treaty. And Thompson writes Washington saying, they won't move. What do I do? And the commanding general from last episode, Duncan Lamont Clinch, still there. He requested more forces separately, saying, this is going to be a problem. Meanwhile, the Seminoles began purchasing an unusual amount of powder and lead.
Is that actually true?
That's, yes. Unusual amount. I mean, you know, they hunt, they shoot things, but also...
I wonder what this could be for.
Yeah, exactly. I wonder. I believe that was actually one of the things that really moved Clinch of like, you know, this could be a problem, but I'm a lot more worried about them preparing than just, you know, the words are words, but I'm seeing some actions going on here.
Logistics will tell you a very fascinating story.
Exactly, exactly. So, after calling another meeting with the chiefs, Thompson read a letter from Andrew Jackson, current president, which emphasized Jackson's willingness to use the military to force the move. The chiefs asked for a month to respond. After the month, they delayed for a whole month, they confirmed that we are not leaving. Thompson and the chiefs kind of began arguing, and Clinch actually had to intervene to prevent bloodshed. This is a pretty tense meeting.
Well, at least he's trying to maintain some sort of peace.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
Nice.
Well, maintaining peace is kind of the army's mission throughout all of this, but there's only so much army.
And there's only so much peace.
Exactly. So eventually, 8 of the chiefs agree to move west, but they once again ask to wait till the end of the year to leave. happy with at least some progress. Both Clinch and Thompson were just very, very ecstatic to just stamp their approval on that.
Relieved to get out of there, it
exactly,
sounds like.
Exactly, exactly. So the eight agreed. However, there were still five major Seminole chiefs and multiple others, smaller, that had not agreed to move. As a result, Thompson, in his capacity as, I believe it was Indian agent was the exact title of his job, he stripped them of their ranks. I'm so glad that he just said, you're no longer a chief, to someone whose authority did not derive from him.
He was just apparently empowered by the U.S. government to supposedly do that kind of thing.
I actually think he probably was in kind of a fit of unrealistic legality.
Strange. Well, I guess the U.S. government, right, at the time...
It's like, we can recognize this tribe and this leader.
It makes sense.
And basically, he probably just pulled recognition. But yeah, it's not exactly something he can really... reasonably do.
It's probably the closest thing that they would have had to, like, you know, cutting off diplomatic ties with, like, a tribal group like this is, like, we're not going to recognize you as a legitimate chieftain, which...
Exactly.
That makes sense. It sounds very silly, because it is, but, like, I mean, I guess so.
It's all he could really do.
Yeah, I mean...
Hoping to maybe stir some internal discontent.
It's about this last club he had in the bag.
Pretty much. So there also at this time was a young native by the name of Osceola, or Billy Powell, as he was known. There's a whole bit with the whole naming system and kind of scheme rather than system, because once again, not a unified group of people. There's tons of different names. A lot of them amusing. And a lot of the army names are amusing as well. It's just kind of a weird time. I'd love to do an epilogue episode on this because there's a lot of crazy stories as well. And stay tuned for that if that comes out.
I think we'll do that. From what you've been telling me when we're not recording here, just over some of these fascinating stories and just the fun name game and all that, I think we should have an epilogue episode at some point.
Absolutely.
So stay tuned for that in the future.
Mm-hmm. But so, yes, Billy Powell... He was essentially a kind of young rabble-rouser who Thompson got along with. He considered him a friend, actually. And there was a time right after this kind of time of discontentment that he was being rowdy and he was detained and arrested. Though Thompson, and I believe he was calling for, you know, armed resistance against the whites. And Thompson detained him. Thompson had a talk with him. He kind of pulled him aside and said, hey, you're causing a problem. And, you know, he had the whole kind of teacher-student kind of talk is kind of how I mentally imagine this, because he eventually lets him go. He gives him back his rifle. He sends him on his way. And that's a mistake. That ends up being a massive mistake, because Osceola, or Billy Powell, becomes a major, major force for the Seminoles. And he leads one of the largest bands, as well as kind of functioning as this weird assassin.
Really?
Yeah. So one of the first things he does is he kills an assenting chief named Charlie Amathla, who was just pretty pacifist. He wanted no part in any war. Didn't want his people to get involved. He was willing to accept a relocation just because he didn't want... He could see the way things were going, and he didn't want to be part of it. So while he was on his horse alone one day... Billy Powell and a few of his men come out of nowhere and just kill him. They just shoot him
just
dead.
Out of the blue.
Yeah.
Huh.
And, you know, does the whole, like, you know, this is what people who cooperate get.
Oh, geez. Yeah. Okay. It's already starting to descend into infighting and really messy. This is what happens, it seems like, when you have a... Because, again, the Seminole right now are kind of pushed to the edge.
Yes.
And societies that get pushed to the edge and have, like, one common enemy but can't necessarily agree because, again, they're very decentralized. They're not even, like, really a unified group.
Exactly,
really. It's a culture group, if even. And so there's already this infighting, the struggle for power that you often see in situations like this. And, boy, it's already starting before the fighting's even truly began.
Yes.
That's pretty rough.
So things are just rapidly deteriorating. Raids are beginning to start very, very small scale. You know, one small settler homestead is being attacked and, you know, they disappear before they can pin it on anybody, of course. It's just, well, these things are happening. Things are getting more and more hostile. And then the big thing happens.
Oh, boy.
And we'll kind of jump two kind of strands at once here. So there is something that is called the Dade Battle that happens, but we'll jump back to that because first I wanted to talk more about Billy Powell, because he finally goes back, and this time on the same day as what comes to be known as the Dade Battle, which is essentially kind of an ambush, but Billy Powell shoots and kills Wiley Thompson and six others just outside of the fort that he was operating from, which I believe is Fort King, just north central Florida, basically. Yes, so Thompson, who is being nice but also is kind of the face of the removal, is just outright killed by Powell. I think it's not too terribly long after he kills Emathla. It's possible that Thompson didn't even know that it had happened yet. But so that's two major figures on the United States' side who are killed in this time. And then comes the Dade Battle, and we'll go into that now.
All right, let's hear it.
So two companies worth of men from the U.S. Army, 110 men actually, left Fort Brooke, which is where modern-day Tampa is. They're being sent to reinforce Fort King, which is where Thompson was working out of, which is north central Florida. They were immediately being shadowed by the Seminoles for 5 days of march. And under the command of General Francis Dade, the column was ambushed on December 28, 1835. Only three men survived, with only two actually making it back to the fort they started at, with the news of the ambush and the destruction of the entire column.
That's pretty rough. Dang. Mm-hmm.
So after the Dade Battle and after Thompson is killed as well as one of the assenting chiefs, it's entirely clear to the army that this war is going to be dangerous, it's going to be costly, and it is going to be relatively large scale. This is as many Seminoles as can be physically mustered, probably fighting on the hostile side. And it went from, we need to just keep them in this reservation, things are heating up, we got to protect the settlers, to, we are under mortal threat ourselves, and who knows if we're going to survive this. And that is kind of the situation they end up in. The Dade Battle is its own kind of fascinating footnote here.
It's barely even a battle, it sounds like. Yeah. They just got slaughtered.
There's a lot of mildly, I guess we would call it now, propaganda, but there is definitely some, you know, good press about a lot of the stuff that happens. There's plenty of battles that are called battles, or they're called wins for the U.S. Army, where it's like, yeah, the Seminoles just ran after they killed like 80 men or so, and then they lost like five, and then they left with their dead normally, so they had no idea how many they killed. It sounds like they lost.
It sounds exactly. Like the U.S. Army just kind of lost.
Yes.
There's no kind of about it, actually. It sounds like they, in fact, lost.
Mm-hmm. The Seminoles are really kicking them on their turf, as to be expected normally.
Yeah, that's. I'm assuming a lot of the guys that were in the army right now were not from Florida.
No, nearly none, of course. There's also a huge contingent. It's about after the Dade Battle that they start raising up volunteers and militia, the typical things in these days. And it's the army regulars who actually start being kind of out of sync with everyone else. The militias are normally from the area. They're a little more skilled at navigating the dense woodland, almost jungle of Florida, essentially the swamps too, though those they're much better in. So the army is just rigid, trying to force them into a field battle, essentially, set-piece battle, and these natives are just shooting them from the trees. It's the Revolutionary War, but, you know, the Americans are now, like the British, losing horribly because they're trying to fight a European-style war, almost.
It kind of reminds me of, because this is mostly contemporaneous with, if you know, the Peninsular War in Europe,
yes.
Right? So Napoleon goes into Spain, and the French want these big set-piece Napoleonic battles with lots of artillery and all that, and mm-hmm. The Spanish guerrillas just go and hide in the mountains and shoot them from afar,
yeah.
And they go and, like, blow up powder kegs, and, like, there are set-piece battles. They're not really gigantic ones, from what mm-hmm. I remember, and it sounds like it's very, like, obviously different terrain, but similar-esque tactics going mm-hmm. on here, where there's a lot more hit-and-run,
lots
of auxiliary forces are actually the better fighters than the main armies.
Exactly, yeah.
That sounds familiar.
Pretty accurate. It's about, you know, probably 20-some years later at least, but still, it is kind of similar.
Yeah, because the Peninsular War, I believe, goes up to, I think it basically goes up to 1814 with the fall of Napoleon
okay,
I.
Because
I think he invades Spain in 1808, something like that. It's mm-hmm. almost a decade, roughly,
yeah,
from what I remember.
Yeah, like 20...
Because it's before Russia is
yeah,
the big thing.
Obviously.
Yeah, well, but those were the two... Everyone forgets that. Well, the invasion of Russia, everyone acts like, oh, that's what totally beat Napoleon. It's like, well, that and the Peninsular War didn't help because that's what actually drained so many soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
But, sorry, this episode's not on that, but
yep.
Maybe one day we'll cover the Peninsular War. It's interesting.
Mm-hmm. But, so, despite these horrific losses they suffered at the Dade Battle, the army hadn't really learned many lessons, aside from we need more men.
That's always the lesson of the U.S. Army, no matter how many. It could be World War II at, like, what, the peak of U.S. military involvement in all of history, and the answer is, we still need more people.
Yeah, exactly. And they really did, just like I mentioned, they wanted these open battles. They wanted to fight them just warrior to warrior in a way, because, you know, they were seeking to avoid these attacks on their civilians. So what better way than to kill the things attacking their civilians, which is the warriors? Well, that doesn't work. Especially when the warriors are much better on the terrain, much better in all these different ways.
They found out really quickly why they were so effective.
Yes.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, there is kind of the old guard system still kind of going on. And believe it or not, these people are not the best at adapting. That is something that you notice in military history. People get better and better at adapting, but man, it's rough in these days. The 1800s are kind of the turning point where people adapt faster and faster as communication gets better, because, you know, 1800 to 1900, the difference in communication is massive.
Yeah, nuts.
And that's really what you can kind of tell that drives this. But at this time, it's not good. And the army in Florida is constantly changing generals. So between the years of 1836 and 1840, the army goes from general to general. It changes later after that to not even generals being in charge. But so it starts with General Clinch, who's just kind of leading the original response. There's raid after raid, fight after fight. And Clinch, by this point, is almost a Florida native. He does a good job at returning these raids back on the Seminoles. They normally were looking for the Seminole villages to try and reach them, but guess what? They're placed in these very annoying spots to go to, where you have to spend a week's journey, and you can get harassed the whole way because they know the terrain better than you, and by the time you get there, guess what? The whole village is empty. And what do you do then? You just go home. There's nothing to do. Like, you can't force them to fight for their home when they've abandoned their home. Their home has been moved. It's like, great.
That's the problem of fighting, because some of the Seminoles are, like, nomadic, right? Like, some of them were in
not many, actually.
They're, like, semi-nomadic might be a better, because some of them, like, were permanent settlements, obviously.
Yes.
But other ones kind of move around the area. I know it. I know
some.
It's some. Not many.
Most
I
did
know.
Actually have,
like, actual structure.
Firm, yes. Yeah. Firm settlements. But also, there's a lot of them. There's many allied groups at this point. They're all mostly working together. So if your village is, you know, there's an army column headed for your village, you just go to another one.
Yeah, you just pick up and leave.
And then in the opening stages of the war here, the army just sees the village empty and goes, well, I guess there's nothing much to do. Scratch their head and go home.
I guess typhoid killed them. Weird. And then just walks away. They also, like, come out of the woods like, okay, they're gone.
Yeah, it's
hide-and-seek champions of 1838.
Exactly. But so yeah, they just have their food stores out in the wilderness, and they would retreat to them, and when the danger was gone, they'd come back. And that works for them. It's just such a simple solution to this problem of this nation, once you gone, just disappear for a little bit, let the heat die down.
I mean, it's a smart move. It makes sense. I mean, why fight the war when you can just avoid the fight and they'll all die of, you know, malaria, and you
exactly,
can point and laugh.
Yep.
It's called fighting, but smartly.
So after Clinch, the actual command goes to General Gaines. And Gaines, unfortunately, this time did not get any gains. He actually had an expedition, like I mentioned, to one of the villages, which was completely unsuccessful. Went home, not really in disgrace, but it was not a great time. A lot of people died, I believe. He was the one who had, honestly, I swear they all had trouble crossing rivers.
It wasn't as easy as
you
think.
No, it's certainly not easy.
Again, Oregon Trail's
should
pretty,
build some bridges.
Yeah, Oregon Trail's pretty accurate, turns out.
Yeah, that is very, very true, especially with all their supply trains and the like. Yeah, no, it's certainly difficult. And Gaines had an expedition that was completely unsuccessful. Then came General Winfield Scott. He did not have a great time either.
That's rare.
I know, right? It's one of the few times he really didn't succeed. The overall war had kind of stabilized at this point, so his reputation kind of, you know, hurried on through intact, but it was not great. Then the governor tried, because he kind of went for, you know, the Clinch strategy of, I know this area, I'm sure I can handle this. Governor Call did not did not have a good time either.
Did he have any military experience?
I don't believe he did.
Sounds about right.
Yeah, he kind of, I believe, used the militia as kind of the initiative and followed up with the army and just, you know, the idea of, oh, we'll get there first, basically, because we know the terrain because I'm using these militia.
Which is not a bad idea,
It's not a bad idea. Again, his general concept was good. The execution turned out slightly poorly.
He just probably didn't have the experience to actually make it happen, but he might have had the right strategy.
That's part of it. The thing is, you learn very quickly, experience doesn't have much to do with this because it's local experience, which Call didn't really have, being a governor, you know? It's not the kind of person, like if I wanted to go right now, call up, actually this is probably a bad example, but call up Doug Burgum and say, hey, where's the best food place in Fargo, North Dakota? You know, preferably somewhere that's not, you know, fancy, kind of a back alley, kind of unknown place. You think he's going to know? Probably not.
It's even now, with all our communication and knowledge, and he's probably been in Fargo a lot, it's like a small chance. So back then, it's very much boots on the ground, this 20-mile range we're fighting over is your knowledge base. They probably have no clue what's going on because, again, they didn't have smartphones.
Yeah, exactly.
It's probably for the best we couldn't see Andrew Jackson of Twitter.
Oh, man.
Or maybe it's for the... Maybe we're all worse off.
I think we're missing out.
We're missing out.
Anyway. Oh, man.
Could you imagine that? It's like, I tried to get the Seminoles out of this village and they all ran away. Where'd they go? That would just be the Twitter posts of everybody in this fight.
Happy Cherokee arriving in Oklahoma. Many such cases.
It'd be awful. Then you get some post from, like, you know, Seminole Warrior, like, you know, what random number scheme. It's like hiding in a bush. They didn't find the LOL. It'd just be like stuff like that. That's what it would be.
Oh. It would be very, very interesting.
It would be great. It would be awful and great.
So, yes, after Seminole Warrior dodged the army column, after he dodged Governor Call, it then went on to a man named General Jessup. Jessup is interesting.
That is the most Civil War name I've ever heard in my life. Did he make it to the Civil War?
I don't believe he... he did, but not in any major capacity. Oh, okay. Almost all of them did. The thing with Jessup, and he starts this strategy, he doesn't... perfect it, as I guess we'll call it. It's not a good strategy to perfect this. You'll understand. So he starts essentially kind of, how do I say this, lying. So with all these changes in command, that kind of very few like strategic and tactical changes were happening, right? There's no success behind all these different changes. However, Mr. Thomas Jessup, General, the new commander in 1836, we are at, he was fresh from the Creek War of 1836, which was in Alabama, and as he took over, he really set out to wear the Seminoles down rather than just, you know, trying to find them and fight them, which, unfortunately, the finding was difficult. And they'd kind of learned by this point that summer was the season to do nothing. Absolutely nothing.
It's the inverse of, you know, you do nothing in the winter.
Exactly. Yeah, sickness kind of ran wild. Supplies ran out quicker. It was a bad, bad time. They also learned at about this time that Jessup takes over that smaller bands were the best to apply pressure to the tribes. You can dodge a whole column with ease because they're moving slowly. These smaller bands of, say, you know, 10 to 20, 20 to 40, that kind of range, you just seek out and destroy homes, livestock, crops. Well, guess what? They can't just run away and come back. They have to now move. So you're at least causing some damage this way. And this is also out of frustration, because at this point, things are not going their way. They've lost plenty of people to everything that's been going on. So there's certainly frustration. I don't even know if it was a tactical decision as much as maybe one soldier started a fire and was like, you know, this isn't a bad idea.
Just out of sheer frustration. Yeah. Because I'm assuming they're taking relatively high casualties for little results.
Relatively, yeah. Like, a band of 20 goes out, one of them gets picked off from the woods, and the rest, you know, you know, creep through the woods and make it to the village, burn down the village, and go home, you know, for Joe or whatever.
Mm-hmm. We did it for Joe.
Yeah, exactly. But that was the kind of stuff that was happening. Now, jumping back to Jessup, who's in charge of this, who's, you know, encouraging these developments... Unfortunately, he also attempts to meet with the Seminole leaders under a white flag, you know, of truce. Then he arrested them. And this is something that continues to happen. It's not just Jessup, though he does, for the rest of his career, try to justify these decisions.
Of course he does.
And this is part of why he's not a big part in the Civil War, because who wants to, you know, deal with Thomas Broken Treaties Jessup?
Yeah, sounds like no one wants to, yeah, that's not a good look, typically. It is. Nor is it easy to work with someone like that.
Exactly. But it's also the first strategy in this war that has results, immediate results, because all of a sudden there's these major players out of the game temporarily. It's not, you know, massive. He wasn't able to get all of the major chiefs in one place, but he got one or two. And he then proceeded to imprison them together. They escaped. It was a whole thing. Again, a lot of crazy stories from this. But essentially, kind of out of sheer desperation, there's just this kind of disregard for the rules that is needed to advance the cause in this, and it's especially notable in stuff like this, like under a flag of truce, just arresting. And it's not the first time it happens, but it's the first major time. And so, at this point, the war just goes back and forth, raids upon raids, back and forth. The army's finally seeing some results, and the issue is kind of an underlying one, that the actual negotiations is you guys are relocating. That's it. There is no real negotiation. It's like, you want a year to relocate? That's all the army can give them is time. And time could easily go against the army. So there's a lot of frustration on their side. And the Seminoles, who obviously don't want to move, there's a lot of frustration on their side. But eventually, things start to kind of draw down, where plenty of Seminoles have been either arrested and then took their bands west, or they just gave up due to starvation or the like and moved west. And they were relatively well compensated. They were still given money. They weren't, you know, given nothing and just pushed out. But it's still obviously not a fair trade from the beginning, which is why they fought. But so in 1842, the now commanding colonel, they've drawn it down from a general to a colonel by this point, whose name is Worth. Real quick, let me jump back up, actually, because there are a few. There's Zachary Taylor is in charge for a year, or no, 2 years, I forgot. He's the longest serving one. He starts as a lieutenant in this war. He jumps up to general. He takes command.
Very fast promotion.
Mm-hmm. Takes command in May 1838, and he hands it off in May 1840, which is basically, May is kind of the end of the campaigning season that I mentioned because of summer.
And he would go off to be president somewhere.
Yes, exactly.
And do things.
Mm-hmm. He also handed off command to another notable treaty breaker, Brigadier General Walker Keith Armistead. Kind of a mouthful of a name. He followed Jessup's strategies, pretty much. He arrested more under a flag of truce. Not a good look. But by this point, they've got enough. And again, 1842, Colonel Worth's in charge. He recommends at this point, look, what's left? Just leave them in peace if they keep to southern Florida. They're out of the way. We've cleared most of the land. And he sends this to the War Department. First time, because most of all these other generals are just like, please transfer me out of here. And they get their request. But Worth decides that, you know, please let them, just let them stay. This is more trouble than it's worth at this point. And he, Worth didn't even plan that. And his request is actually granted. The Seminoles were kept in kind of an informal reservation. It wasn't formal as the other one was, but Worth is given permission to declare the war as over at a date of his choosing. So in August of that year, 1842, the Armed Occupation Act passes Congress. This is kind of a precursor to the Homestead Act, actually. In essence, it declares any settler is given free land if they improve it and prepare to defend themselves against natives. While they couldn't claim within 2 miles of a military outpost, they were free to settle elsewhere at pretty much as they pleased. There's a lot of specifics, of course, but it's relatively free reign. And this is obviously going to open the floodgates for people to settle in this area, as well as west, but it's also, like I said, precursor to the Homestead Act, and it's really, really similar from what I saw. And so Worth calls together all the remaining chiefs in Florida, many of them very suspicious of a call to meet by this point, and with one final offer of relocation with a rifle, money, and a year's worth of rations, He declares the Second Seminole War as ended on August 14th, 1842. Plenty of them had taken that deal. Plenty of them decided to stay. And that's where the second one ends. It's kind of a weird ending because nothing really changed. It was a gradual change over time of the Seminoles being forced west, the armed bands being subdued by certainly dishonorable, not necessarily illegal, because at this point they didn't really recognize these people as chiefs, as people, you know. So it's the kind of thing that isn't a happy ending really for anyone except for the settlers, because even the army's not happy with this result, but at least they don't have to send people out to fight the Seminoles anymore, right? And that works for a while. The peace lasts, and then we get on to the Third War. This is over a decade later. 1855 is when this starts up. I'll just kind of be brief because it is brief. It is so small scale in comparison. They've been relegated to this reservation, mostly with the Everglades and Big Cypress Swamp and some good land on the edge of it. And they still want the land. And this is more incited by the settlers than the army. Army does nothing aside from this one incident, actually, that I'm about to talk about. So the army conducts this raid on a Seminole plantation. Its true purpose of the attack was possibly just provoke the Seminoles. There is no real justification. If it was sparked by a raid, these raids have been happening for years. It's just the border tension, the typical thing. The thing that didn't start the Second War, you know? These things had been happening from the first to the second. Nothing really happened. The third, the army just kind of kicks off because it needs to end, is kind of the thought process. And at this point, it's been a decade since the Second War. Almost everyone who had experience is out of the area. And in a way, they see the Seminoles as finished, because by this point, there's less than 10,000 for certain, probably less than 5,000.
Yeah, I'm assuming Florida wouldn't be hugely populous at the time, but it would have been exponentially grown, I believe,
yes,
in the past few decades of settlers and all that coming
exactly,
in.
Exactly, yes. And in that decade, yes, the white population of Florida had ballooned compared to the Seminoles' relatively declining population. And again, the whole time, there's still people accepting relocation as well, so there's nothing but an outflow of Seminoles. So the balance of power is just so different by this point that after a few raids back and forth, the army mainly focusing civilian targets, 3 years of fighting, but it's not a real war. And by 1858, the remaining Seminoles, with the exception of perhaps 500 to 800, had accepted relocation. This one just, it really quickened the flow out, and then it was pretty much over. The rest kind of faded away into Big Cypress Swamp, the Everglades, land that wasn't desired by any settlers, and it was determined that it'd kind of be more trouble than it was worth to get rid of them. They weren't causing as many problems. And with that, the third Seminole War ends.
And I believe the people who were in the Seminole groups that stayed on later, some of them formed the Muscogee tribe that I mentioned last episode,
yes,
I believe, which was, again, they were a tribe that was, like, I guess, it was, like, recognized by the federal government in the 1960s.
Yes.
And they have...
They remained in Florida.
They never left. They were some of the remnants of like the last bits of like Seminole resistance, and mm-hmm. now they have like officially recognized tribe and all that. So that's where that little kind of seeming footnote from the Third War actually does come into have, you know, relevance to the modern day. So
yeah, exactly. And just this whole thing is just very, very important. The Seminole Wars are, in my opinion, in a lot of ways, equally as important as the Mexican-American War, which everybody thinks is, you know, oh, this is kind of the precursor to the Civil War. You've got all the generals, you got the army fighting in this way. And that's absolutely true, but the Seminole Wars are kind of the dark underbelly of the Civil War. It's, you know, the march to the sea, most prominently. It's the smaller engagements in the West. That is what the Seminole Wars taught the U.S. Army, those commanders, and plenty of commanders on either side, Confederacy or the Union, both were in the Seminole Wars. Most notably, Joe E. Johnston and William Tecumseh Sherman on each side, respectively. And there are plenty of other ones on other sides.
And for those
as well.
Who might not recognize Joe Johnston, I believe he was basically the head of the Confederate Army before Robert E.
Yes,
Lee.
Yes, he was.
For like a whole year in the Civil War, something like that?
A decent amount of time,
And then, of course, Sherman is, well, I think most people know Sherman.
Yes,
so,
exactly.
Who, I guess if you don't know, was very, very important for the Union War, for particularly towards the end where it was, I mean, essentially the March of the Sea was basically a gigantic raiding band slash horde that just slashed the South. It wasn't like an actual army going through fighting, you know, pitched battles.
Oh,
it was we're gonna go down and burn down the entirety of the South, which they basically succeeded in like really honestly, if you look at the details of the stories, it gets pretty gruesome, like happened in the Civil War.
Exactly. And that's the kind of basic strategy that was pioneered in the Seminole Wars, because that was their strategy. They'd go in, they'd burn down all the civilian targets, they'd break the means to make war, and that was, you know, an organized army doing this. And
it's essentially trying to shatter their society.
Exactly, exactly. And it worked to great effect in both the Civil War and the Seminole Wars. And the Second Seminole War was the one where Sherman himself was present, and he was there for the tail end of it. It was something that affected him, it seemed, but he doesn't spare it too much time in his own memoirs, actually. Everything is a formative experience when you're young, and that was when his first assignment, I believe, out of West Point. Something like that. First, second, in that area.
Early career.
Early career, yes.
And a very long career in the Army.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
And also, it should be noted that I believe he ended his career in the Midwestern Indian Plains Wars, right?
Yes,
because
yes,
that's because he was, like, basically, what was his title? Like, was he... I can't remember. I know he was, like, a general, obviously, but was he, like, commander of, like, the entire U.S. Army, basically? Or, like, I know he planned a lot of the Plains Wars.
Yeah, I don't remember if he was,
I don't remember what his
though.
Effective, like, title was, but he was basically the head honcho, for lack of a better term, of this thing going on in the Midwest, which, I mean, he's out here fighting the Lakota and all that.
Exactly, yeah. And that's the same thing with a lot of other people from the Seminole Wars, actually, because there's certain figures like William Harney, who I would have loved to talk more about. He survived a massacre that's named after him because he was pretty much the only survivor. He was a commanding officer, and he managed to survive an attack on his post. And, it was called the Harney Massacre, and he lives. He's the only one.
What a
much.
Legacy to leave behind.
Yep.
What a very strange.
This is the same guy who's known to the Lakota as, you know, man who keeps his word, but also woman killer. Like, they really just cut with that name.
The names were just wild at this time.
Mm-hmm. He was also one of the few ones who led successful expeditions in the Second Seminole War as well, again, towards the end. But, again, so many crazy stories. I'd love to go into them some other time. But just kind of a little tidbit I'd like to leave right at the end here. There are some really delightful names. And like I mentioned earlier, a lot of these are defeats that are played up like victories.
For the U.S. Army, that is.
Exactly, exactly, for the Army. Like the Battle of Wahoo Swamp.
What a great name.
The Battle of Lake Okeechobee.
I've heard of that, at least the lake. I haven't heard of the battle.
Yeah, Lake Okeechobee is actually pretty important, but just the name in general just kind of makes me laugh a little bit. Battle of Loxahatchee, kind of the same thing there. Yeah. I don't know what it is, but there's all these names of places. Yeah, and then you've got, you know, the wonderful name, which is absolutely not wonderful, but the Harney Massacre and all this stuff, the Dade Battle. It's just they've got these kind of weird names.
They sound like they have some sort of weight to them in this very weird, almost non-tangible way.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
When you say the Harney Massacre, you know, the Battle of Wahoo Swamp, yeah, you know, the all these other things, it just sounds like there's like there should be something important or relevant about that. Like, I should research this.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
It just kind of sits, it strikes you.
Mm-hmm. Wahoo Swamp definitely sounds like a Nintendo level, but
it sounds like Woohoo Island was the thing. I almost made that joke, but that's what it sounds like.
That's exactly what it sounds like. But, yeah, just kind of wanted to mention that because that's kind of a little tidbit of what this epilogue would be, just these crazy stories, these silly names, it seems like, in the modern day.
Yeah, I think we should definitely do an epilogue episode, go into more of the minute details about the Seminole Wars, because there's a lot to wrap up in. We want to give you a good overview of the actual history. Well, it's all actual history, you know what I mean? Like, the storyline of the events here, but there's all those wonderful little details that get lost in the, you know, just telling you the facts of what happened.
Yeah,
we want to focus on the smaller facts, if you will, the stories, that
the
kind of thing.
The interesting tidbits, the kind of stuff that, you know, this isn't important for me to know to understand these wars, but man, is it just amusing or
and
at least interesting. Yeah.
It's worthy of study its own way. It's like stories from any war. You always find these interesting little events or goings on or happenings, these interesting tales of things that go on. There's certainly a whole genre of, you know, military storytelling out there.
Oh, exactly. And this war is definitely part of that, because this was, you know, this was kind of one of their big formative wars that's going on, that all these people who eventually would become, you know, these grizzled veterans by the time the Civil War rolls around.
It sounds like a lot of guys get their experience and are fed into the Civil War pretty
soon after this. And that's kind of the big takeaway, is this is a precursor to the Civil War in so many ways for the U.S. Army, and it's just this great snapshot of just what things looked like at this time. And I think that's kind of a great closing remark here.
Absolutely. So, again, no final thoughts, anything like that? Nothing else?
No final thoughts, aside from, if you're interested, take a look more into this yourself. You'll be very, very pleased with what you find, I'm sure. If you're into this stuff from what I've been talking about, you'll enjoy a deeper dive, I can assure you.
Do you have any sources to point others to at all? Anywhere you would suggest they go? Like, I don't know, is it like a library in Florida, like on their website or something, on like the state website or anything like that?
I wish it was that simple, unfortunately.
I wish history was that simple.
Mm-hmm. Most of the primary sources I looked at for this were, you know, the diaries of the generals and the like. I would actually, I know people hate this in the academic world, and I understand why for many, many reasons, because it's chained all the time, but look at Wikipedia and look at the primary sources that things are cited with, because that's where I love to go. That's a first step for any good
just
researcher.
Check their bibliography.
Just kind of check the bibliography, take a look at those, and see if you can search up something similar on some sort of academic search,
like
or that exact
like that.
Thing. Exactly. JSTOR is probably the best. But
it's something that will be snoots will, you know, look down upon. But again, if it's just a way to find the sources, you're not just reading Wikipedia.
Exactly.
Articles to
us,
which is always my intent, is not to just. In fact, I almost never look at Wikipedia myself when I'm making these episodes. I always just go into JSTOR and search stuff up. But again, as a first place to look, as a directory, and then, oh, I can find this source, this source, this source. It's valid. I'm not going to knock it.
Exactly. And it does really put these sources together in a kind of a cohesive way, too, which I really like. It's like, okay, you know, if I'm looking for this part, which is early on in the war, I should look here and, you know, mid-war here, that kind of stuff. And especially helpful with this because, man, these diaries and stuff, because like I mentioned, Sherman comes in towards the end, but someone like Harney's there mostly from the beginning. So it's just all this, you know, kind of crazy stuff. Piecing it together is difficult, and that's what I'd recommend because, like I said, if you're interested, you'll be very, very intrigued by what you find.
All right. Well, again, thank you very much for doing the series episodes. We'll have you on for the next one where we wrap things up with the epilogue here.
Sounds
and kind of cover all the last little tidbits of this whole series we're doing. So again, thank you very much, Jacob, for being on. Always joy to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
Anytime. And otherwise, that's all I have for you today. So thank you for enjoying this wonderful episode of Side Stories. If you're ever down there in Florida, go and explore the swamplands. Maybe you'll find some old artifacts left over from the Seminole Wars. I don't know. Or you'll get eaten by an alligator. I don't know.
No promises. Yeah.
No promises. Anything can happen down there is what I've learned. From its entire history, Florida's just been a nut house of craziness. And
exactly.
Isn't that just wonderful? Don't we need more places like that in the world? I think we do, because the world can't be boring. It can't be boring. That's the lesson for the day. Don't be boring.
Absolutely.
We will see you all in the next one, folks. Thank you for listening. Bye.